Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are tackling what may be one of the biggest questions there is, really. Are we alone out here?
It's definitely up there. And we're diving into it through Wade Ruch's fantastic book, Extraterrestrials. It looks at this whole, you know, centuries-long quest for life beyond Earth.
Right. And what Ruch does so well, I think, is frame it not just as sci-fi speculation, but as a real scientific journey.
Exactly. He argues pretty compellingly that the mission, in a way, has already succeeded, not because we found aliens, obviously, but because the process of searching, the methods, the technology, it's totally changed our understanding of the cosmos.
And our place in it. That's why it's so relevant now, is that it's moved out of the realm of like pure philosophy or late night radio shows into actual data-driven science, astrobiology. And it forces us, you know, to look in the mirror. It's not just about them. It's about defining us.
That's a huge part of it. The book's core idea is that the journey itself, the act of looking and thinking about it systematically, has paid off massively. Planetary science, understanding life's limits, even thinking about our own future.
Our own survival, really.
Yes, exactly. The existential risks. It all ties together.
Okay, so before we get deeper into the ideas, let's talk about Wade Ruch himself. Because his background is kind of perfect for this, right?
It really is. He's a longtime science and tech journalist, senior editor at MIT Technology Review. So he knows how to communicate complex stuff.
But he's not just a journalist. He's got the academic chops, too.
That's the key bit. He has a PhD from MIT in the history of science and technology. So he brings this dual perspective. He sees the science, but also the history of the question itself, how humans have grappled with this idea over centuries.
From ancient philosophers wondering about other worlds right up to, you know, the SETI project listening for radio signals.
Precisely. So he can translate these really technical concepts, SETI signal processing, exoplanet atmospheres, whatever, but also put them in that broader human context. He's a historian of our own cosmic curiosity.
And it feels like he's really talked to the people involved, too.
Oh, definitely. The book draws heavily on interviews with pioneers like Frank Drake, Jill Tarter, the people who actually built the field. That gives it, you know, real authority, but also makes it a human story, not just dry science.
Okay, so we have our guide. What's the central message he's trying to get across in Extraterrestrials?
Fundamentally, he wants to give us a rational, evidence-based way to think about life beyond Earth, sort of cut through the myths, the assumptions, and focus on the scientific method as it's being applied.
Right. Replace the X-Files vibe with actual methodology.
Pretty much. And right away, he sets up this core intellectual tension that runs through the whole book. It's the clash between, on one hand, this growing statistical optimism.
All those billions of planets we now know are out there.
Exactly. The sheer numbers are staggering. But on the other hand, you have this stark reality, the great silence. If the universe should be teeming with life, well, where is everybody? Why haven't we heard anything?
That silence is almost deafening, isn't it? And that tension is what Ruch explores using a few key intellectual tools. Let's start with the big one, the Drake equation.
Ah, yes. Frank Drake, 1961. N-R-U-F-L-U-F-L-U-F-L-U-F-L-L. Looks intimidating, maybe.
A little bit.
But Ruch explains it beautifully. He calls it a framework for organizing our ignorance. That's the key. It's not meant to spit out a precise number of alien civilizations.
It's more like a checklist, a way to break down one enormous question, how many are out there, into smaller, maybe more manageable pieces.
Exactly. Seven factors, starting with things astronomy can tackle, like the rate of star formation, the fraction of stars with planets, a number of those planets that could actually support life.
And this is where things have changed dramatically, right? When Drake first wrote it down, those first terms were almost pure guesswork.
Completely. Now, thanks to space telescopes like Kepler, we have actual data. Hard numbers. We know planets aren't rare. They're everywhere.
Ubiquitous.
Yes. And not just planets, but planets in the habitable zone, the Goldilocks zone, potentially billions in our galaxy alone.
Yeah.
So those first few variables in the equation, they're looking pretty large.
So the astronomers have kind of done their part, in a sense. They've shown us the potential is vast.
That's a great way to put it. Ruch really highlights this shift. The uncertainty, the big unknowns, have moved down the equation.
Towards the biology and sociology.
Precisely. The next terms are phys-L, the fraction of habitable planets where life actually arises. Then phi, the fraction of those where intelligence evolves. Then FC, the fraction of intelligent life that develops technology we can detect, like radio signals. And finally, the length of time those civilizations release detectable signals. How long do they last?
And those we have almost no data for. That's where the ignorance is still profound.
Absolutely. We've gone from an astronomical problem to a biological and maybe most critically, a sociological one. That L term, longevity. How long does a technologically advanced species typically survive before, well...
Before it wipes itself out or transcends technology or just goes quiet?
Right. That's the multi-trillion dollar question now.
But even before we get to the really heavy stuff, there's something powerful just in the method of the Drake equation, isn't there? This idea of disaggregation.
Oh, absolutely. It's a fantastic tool for tackling any huge, complex problem where you have massive uncertainty. Break it down. What parts do we know or can we estimate? What are the real bottleneck variables we need to focus on?
You could apply that to climate change or market forecasting or anything really complex.
You really could. Identify the knowns, isolate the unknowns. It's a very practical way to think.
Okay, so the Drake equation suggests, based on the knowns, that there should be others out there.
Hmm.
But then we hit that wall again.
The wall of silence, which brings us to the second major concept, yeah. The Fermi paradox.
Enrico Fermi, the physicist. Wasn't it just an off-the-cuff remark over lunch in 1950?
It supposedly was, just a casual, but where is everybody? But it captures this profound contradiction. The galaxy is incredibly old, billions of years older than Earth.
Plenty of time for life to arise elsewhere, develop intelligence, technology.
And even if interstellar travel is slow, like much slower than light speed, a civilization could theoretically colonize or send probes across the entire Milky Way in, geologically speaking, a relatively short amount of time. Millions of years, maybe, not billions.
So we should see something. Signals, probes, artifacts, Dyson spheres, something.
That's the logic. So the fact that we see nothing, this great silence, isn't just a lack of data. Ruch argues it is data. It's perhaps the most significant finding of SETI so far. The universe appears empty, and that demands an explanation.
So how do we explain it? Ruch goes through some possibilities, starting with the more optimistic ones. Ways they could be out there, but we just don't see them.
Right. Maybe the search space is just too vast. Think of the sky, all the frequencies, all the directions, all the time. We've barely scratched the surface. It's the cosmic haystack problem. We might just be looking in the wrong place at the wrong time or listening for the wrong kind of signal.
Or maybe the technology is just beyond us. We're listening for radio waves, but perhaps advanced civilizations use neutrinos or gravitational waves or something we haven't even conceived of yet.
That's another possibility. Or maybe they're not broadcasting outwards at all. Perhaps they've, you know, turned inward, uploaded themselves into virtual realities, or focused on managing their local environment rather than expanding.
And then there's the slightly unsettling one, the zoo hypothesis.
Yeah, that one gives you pause. The idea that they know we're here, but they're deliberately staying hidden, like we're in a cosmic wildlife preserve.
And they're observing us, maybe waiting for us to mature somehow, following a sort of prime directive not to interfere.
Could be. It implies a conscious choice on their part, a sociological or political reason for the silence, not just a technical one. But, well, all these explanations, they feel a bit like we're trying really hard to avoid the simplest conclusion, don't they?
Which is?
That they're just not there. Or, perhaps more chillingly, that something prevents civilizations from getting to the point where we detect them.
Okay, this sounds like where the great filter comes in.
Exactly. This concept, coined by Robin Hanson, is maybe the most profound and sobering idea in the book. It proposes there's some massive barrier, some incredibly difficult step in the evolution of life or civilization that is so hard to overcome that almost no one ever makes it past.
A bottleneck, a cosmic choke point.
Precisely. And the critical question Ruch poses, the one that really sticks with you, is this. Is that great filter in our past, or is it still ahead of us?
Wow. Okay. So if it's behind us, what would that mean?
That's the optimistic view, relatively speaking. It means we've already passed the hardest test. Maybe the origin of life itself, abiogenesis, is incredibly rare. Or perhaps the jump from simple prokaryotic cells to complex eukaryotic cells like ours, maybe that was the near impossible step.
So if the filter's behind us, we might genuinely be rare, or even unique in the galaxy. And the future could be wide open for us.
That's the implication. A vast, empty cosmos waiting for us. It's hopeful in a lonely sort of way.
But aim. The alternative. if the filter is ahead of us.
That's the truly disturbing possibility. It suggests that the hardest part isn't evolving intelligence, it's surviving it. The great silence in this view isn't empty space, it's a graveyard.
A graveyard of civilizations that reached our level of technology, or maybe a bit beyond, and then destroyed themselves.
Yes. The filter becomes some near inevitable consequence of advanced technology. Runaway climate change, uncontrollable AI, genetically engineered plagues, nuclear holocaust, and take your pick, the things we worry about today.
So Roosh uses this concept to basically turn the searchlight back on ourselves. Our own existential risks aren't just like political problems. They could be manifestations of a universal law.
That's the chilling takeaway. The silence might be telling us that the odds of long-term survival for a species like ours are terrifyingly low. Reading that section, you really feel the weight of it. We're looking for neighbors, but we might just be staring at our own potential fate.
Okay, that's a lot to process.
Uh-huh.
Let's maybe pivot slightly to some of the broader themes Roosh pulls out of this whole search. You mentioned earlier the value of the search itself.
Right. Regardless of finding ET, the process has huge benefits. It forces us to think long-term on cosmic timescales. It fosters international scientific collaboration. SETI projects often involve researchers from many countries. And it drives innovation in unexpected areas like computing, signal processing, data analysis, stuff that has applications far beyond astronomy.
That makes sense. And another theme seems to be how the search constantly forces us to redefine what life and habitability even mean.
Absolutely. We used to think life needed conditions very similar to Earth's surface. Then we discovered extremophiles.
Life thriving in boiling volcanic vents, under miles of ice, in highly acidic or radioactive environments.
Exactly. And that discovery completely blew open our ideas about where life might exist elsewhere. Suddenly, those subsurface oceans on moons like Europa or Enceladus don't seem like such long shots. Maybe life doesn't need a sunlit surface at all. Our definition of habitable keeps expanding.
Which ties into another idea you mentioned, cosmic humility.
Yes. Roosh really emphasizes this. The search, whether successful or not, forces us to confront our place in the universe. Are we special? Are we unique? Or are we just one ordinary example of a common cosmic phenomenon? Either answer is profound. And the silence, so far, suggests maybe intelligence like ours is fragile, or the universe is vaster and more challenging than we imagine.
That idea of humility feels like it has real-world applications, like the perspective it gives you.
Definitely. Roosh talks about how the lack of evidence isn't proof of absence, but it is evidence of, well, something. Maybe the vastness of space, maybe the limits of our technology, maybe the difficulty of interstellar communication. It demands humility.
And seeing our own planet, our own species, against that vast cosmic backdrop, it can make our own conflicts seem smaller, maybe. Foster a sense of shared destiny.
I think that's one of the most powerful potential side effects of the search, that overview effect the astronauts talk about, but for everyone, realizing we're all crew on this one small spaceship, Earth, facing potentially cosmic challenges together.
So if you had to pick out a couple of really notable ideas or quotes that encapsulate the book's message.
Well, that redefinition of failure is a big one. The absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, but it is evidence of something. It forces you to think scientifically about the silence itself.
Yeah, I like that. It turns a negative result into a positive piece of information. Mm-hmm. In a way.
Another key idea is that connection between the outer search and the inner one. The search for ET is ultimately a search to understand ourselves, our uniqueness, or our place in a larger community.
What about what surprised you most reading it, or something you particularly loved?
For me, the most surprising thing was just how much the ground has shifted because of exoplanet discoveries. It's not theoretical anymore that habitable worlds are common. That's observational fact. It totally changes the probabilities and focuses the mystery squarely on biology and that scary L factor longevity. The cosmology part is kind of solved. The problem is now life and survival.
Yeah, that really struck me too. What I think I loved most was just the sweep of it all. Roosh tracing this deep, persistent human desire to know our context from ancient times to now. It shows this incredible, stubborn curiosity that feels, well, fundamentally human. This need to ask, are we alone? And what does it mean if we are or if we aren't?
It really is one of our oldest and deepest questions.
So maybe a final thought to leave people with.
Yeah.
Is it that the answer almost doesn't matter as much as the asking?
I think that's a big part of it. The act of asking, of searching, of developing the science and the perspective to even attempt to answer it, that process has already changed us. It's made us a species capable of thinking on a planetary scale, maybe even a cosmic one.
Whether we find anyone or not, the search itself has been transformative. It's a mirror reflecting our own capabilities, our fears, and maybe, hopefully, our potential to survive that great filter wherever it lies.
A profound responsibility, when you put it like that.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.